Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Two just-released U.S. government reports on Iraq are in sharp disagreement over progress in that country. The Defense Department's quarterly assessment to Congress says security, political, and economic trends in Iraq continue to be positive, if fragile. An independent report issued by the Government Accountability Office says that several of the crucial measures the Bush administration uses to demonstrate progress on those fronts are either incorrect or overstated. And the GAO goes on to assert that the administration lacks a meaningful strategy to move beyond the troop surge launched in January of 2007. And that military buildup is about to end. As the last of the five additional combat brigades heads home, U.S. troop levels in Iraq will fall to 142,000 by mid-July. We're speaking with Dmitry Savastopulo, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. And Dmitry, both reports are in agreement that violence has dropped significantly. But in other areas, the Washington Post said today that these two reports seem to assess wholly different realities. So let's start with the readiness of the Iraqi army. How are these reports reading it differently?
Well, Monica, the big difference between the reports in that respect is that the Pentagon says that roughly 10% of Iraqi troops are capable of operating what they call in the lead with U.S. support. The GAO says that the Pentagon should really be looking at how many Iraqi troops can operate completely independently without American support, and they say that that number is still woefully low.
So how do you account for the difference? It's in determining how they're operating exactly?
Well, I think what the Pentagon has said in the past is that one of the things that's happening in Iraq is as the Iraqi security forces build cohesive units with good leadership and then strong capabilities down through the ranks, when they've built a cohesive unit, they've then taken some of the leaders out of that unit and brought them in to start new units. So they say that the positive spin on this is that you're bringing leaders, you're developing a leadership cadre, which can then build out more units. The negative side is that when you have a cohesive unit, all of a sudden it's no longer as cohesive. That's a strategy the Iraqis are pursuing, which they think over the long term will be successful. But obviously in the short term, it means that the statistics don't look as favorable for the U.S. as they might like.
And it's worth pointing out that the GAO report quotes a U.S. commander in Baghdad saying there are no areas that we would be willing to give over specifically to Iraqi forces. So what about the overall security assessment in these reports?
This is where they are generally in agreement. I think both reports would say that violence is down dramatically, particularly since the 30,000 surge forces arrived in Iraq roughly by June, July last year. A combination of the additional 30,000 forces, also the emergence of groups called Sons of Iraq, which are these local, predominantly Sunni but increasingly Shia volunteer groups that have allied with the U.S. to protect their neighborhoods from al-Qaeda extremists. And thirdly, over the last almost a year now, there's been a ceasefire by Muqtada al-Sadr, the radical firebrand Shia cleric, whose Mahdi army militias have been quite potent. And although there have been moments where the ceasefire has looked fragile, it has generally held. And I think a combination of those three factors, the Americans say, and the GAO would also agree, has led to a decline in violence.
Well, the differences seem to be most striking in this report when it comes to the functioning of the Iraqi government. The Pentagon says that the Iraqi government's budget doubled between 2005 and 2008, but the GAO says that's because of the increase in value of the Iraqi currency and a fourfold increase in the budgets of Iraq's security ministries. What's the real budget situation?
Well, we don't know, and the budget situation in Iraq is very opaque. It's very difficult to work out what's going on. I mean, for example, in Capitol Hill here in the U.S., you've had a lot of criticisms that the Iraqis have a budget surplus because of the oil revenues due to the high crude oil prices around the world, and yet don't seem to be able to spend that. So there is a sharp disagreement in the report over that. It's worth pointing out that the Pentagon report tends to be more focused on the security situation, whereas the GAO report is looking more broadly at when President Bush in January of 2007 announced the surge as part of what he called the new way forward for Iraq. He said that the surge was going to provide the security that would allow the Iraqis to pursue political reconciliation that's considered crucial for long-term stability in Iraq. And what the GAO report is pointing out is that while some key legislation has been passed, although belatedly, the Iraqi government hasn't been able to develop mechanisms to implement the legislation. So big questions remain over how much progress the Iraqi government is making.
And Dimitri, just briefly, how will these reports play in Washington as we head toward national elections?
Both Barack Obama and John McCain, the Democratic and Republican candidates for president, will probably pick out of the reports what suits their platforms. Essentially, we're into the kind of silly season in Washington where it's going to be more about the election and less about policy. Ultimately, General Petraeus, the top U.S. commander in Iraq, is going to make a recommendation roughly the end of August as to whether he thinks the decline in violence will permit the U.S. to withdraw more troops. The Pentagon, I think, would like to withdraw another combat brigade, which is roughly 3,500 troops, before the end of the year. But we'll have to wait and see what General Petraeus recommends and then whether President Bush accepts that recommendation.
Dimitri, thanks very much.
Thank you, Monica.
Dimitri Savastopoulou, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. It's been in place for less than a week, but already the fragile truce between Israel and Gaza Strip militants has been breached. Palestinian forces fired 3 homemade rockets into southern Israel today. Israel condemned the attack as a gross violation of the truce. Also today, Israeli forces killed 2 Palestinians, including an Islamic Jihad commander in the West Bank. Although the region's not covered by the truce, a spokesman for Islamic Jihad said the raid had soured the atmosphere of calm. The 6-month-long truce, which was brokered by Egypt, includes the opening of several border crossings, easing Gaza's isolation and allowing goods and people to come in and out of the region. But the truce and relative calm in Gaza come as tensions between Israel and Iran mount, with Israel allegedly undertaking long-range attack rehearsals over the Mediterranean and Tehran stating it would deliver a, quote, devastating response to any attack. Middle East blogger, commentator, and author Bernard Avishai joins us on the line. And Mr. Avishai, let's start with Gaza. The news we're seeing today shows a breach in the truce. Are you hopeful about this deal?
Well, I suppose one is hopeful about any deal because when you're living in a vendetta culture on both sides, any period of calm, begins a process of everyone cooling their jets and beginning to think about the future, which is what's so necessary there. But I also think that, realistically, this is sort of like the Gaza pullout, a 5-foot leap over a 7-foot pit. I mean, you have a decision to make a deal on the Gaza front. There's no particular deal on the West Bank front. And it's almost impossible to conceive a situation where the gangs, that's what, Hamas and Islamic Jihad are in a way, they're sort of youth gangs run by fairly older people. It's hard to imagine that, when you have an attack on the gang in the West Bank, you're not going to get some kind of response from the Gaza front, and then the whole thing starts to unravel.
So it's all connected. But why now? Does it have anything to do with a scandal-plagued Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert, who's trying to hold on to power?
No, I don't really believe that. I think it's a mistake to think of Olmert as a one-man show. Olmert is at the head of a coalition of a Labor Party and a centrist party called Kadima, and the elites that are represented in these parties really have an attitude that's pretty wall-to-wall, that they want some period of calm, they want Israeli companies and professionals to integrate into the world, and they want to get on with some kind of deal, some kind of two-state solution, some kind of integration into the larger European vision. And I think that, this is the first step one way or the other. So Olmert has a lot of problems and he'll probably be replaced. The danger is that Olmert won't just be replaced by sort of stepping aside. The danger is he'll actually resign, which according to the Israeli constitution means that his government becomes a transitional government and you have to go to new elections. If new elections bring in Bibi Netanyahu and the kind of coalition he represents, well, then that would really be a significant obstacle to continuing negotiations with any of the parties.
Well, some Israelis, including the vice premier, Haim Ramon, are concerned that this six-month ceasefire will benefit Hamas militants. That's going to give them a chance to reorganize, regroup, and rearm themselves ultimately. What are your thoughts about that?
Look, I think realistically, Hamas will continue to arm itself one way or the other. Hamas, Islamic Jihad, these groups have no raison d'etre unless they're organizing for the contingency of a fight to the finish. Israel is also arming itself all the time, upgrading its ways of dealing with its potential enemies. Hamas will continue to arm itself, secretly or openly. I don't think there's any way this can be avoided. The question is whether you really leap the full 10 feet, which is begin to get an overarching settlement in which over the next generation, the people who are gravitating into Hamas feel that there's an alternative to that. Instead of joining the gang, maybe we should get a job. Maybe we should start a business or go to school. That's the only way in which the hard feelings and the murderous, revenge-laden actions that you see coming from Gaza are going to slowly be dissipated.
The U.S. and Europe classify Hamas as a terrorist organization, and thus they weren't involved in the negotiations of this ceasefire. It was brokered by Egypt, as I mentioned. Does that in any way diminish the status of the agreement?
Well, some say that dealing with Hamas actually strengthens the agreement because you know you're dealing with the enemy who really has to be responsive to the things that they commit to. Hamas is unquestionably an organization that has been involved in despicable acts of terrorism. There's no question about that. So was, by the way, the Fatah leadership, which we are now calling our partners in the process. They were the ones who did Munich, for God's sake, the Munich massacre of the Israeli Olympics. It's just the way things are there, and I think ultimately Israel is going to have to deal with Hamas either directly or by a third party, and eventually Hamas will have to use these periods of calm to prove that they're actually also interested in a political process and will eventually be integrated into a political process the same way that other terrorist organizations in the past have been, including, by the way, Jewish groups in the 1940 to 50 period who themselves engaged in acts of terror.
We're talking with Bernard Avishai, author of The Hebrew Republic. When we return, we'll take a look at the rising tensions between Israel and Iran. Is Israel seriously considering an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities? There's more ahead, here and now. We've been talking to Mideast blogger and author Bernard Avishai about the delicate truce between Israel and Gaza militants and the prospect for a long-term peace agreement in the region. But let's move now into a broader arena and talk about Israel and Iran. Earlier this month, Israel carried out a major exercise. More than 100 Israeli fighter planes launched a 900-mile maneuver. The exercise was widely considered to be a rehearsal for an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities. Was this Israel's way of telling the international community it means business?
I think it's a way of Israel telling Iran that when the U.S. is saying all means are still on the table, that this is one of them. I doubt that Israelis or even Israeli military and strategic planners believe that they can unilaterally attack Iran. I think what they want to do is signal that the idea is still being entertained because it may reinforce diplomatic negotiations. But I think, Israelis know very well that no military attack can really be effective against all the dispersed sites that Iran has, that they have plenty of petrodollars to rebuild anything that is attacked. And besides that, if they did attack, Iran has all kinds of means of retaliating that neither the Israelis nor the Americans would find clean victory for themselves. So I see the threat of it as part of an overarching diplomatic approach. What I do think is sort of interesting is, you know, Israelis think of this a little symbolically. They want the West to show Iran that at least this is being entertained. It's sort of like a declaration of solidarity with Israel to entertain the idea of an attack, because this, most Israelis feel, is a way of saying, you really get it. This is something we consider an existential threat. And if you entertain the idea of attacking our existential threat, that means you really care about our existence. But aside from that, frankly, I just don't think a unilateral attack is realistic.
Well, how does that play into what John Bolton, the former American ambassador to the United Nations, told The Telegraph recently, that he predicted Israel would attack Iran after the November presidential election, but before George W. Bush's successor? How does U.S. politics in this election play into what's happening between Israel and Iran?
Well, I think Israelis view the American presidential election as consequential. The same way most of the people in the world do. You have one candidate that seems willing to play this game of entertaining the idea of a military attack and making that front and center to policy. McCain, obviously. You have another candidate who is saying, you know, America has to change the way it does business in the world. It has to stop emphasizing America's ability to deter and start emphasizing America's ability to attract, that we need to be patient over a generation. We need to unleash the positive soft power of globalization. And, you know, as we contain the Russians in the Cold War, we have to think about the Islamic world as having elements that need to be contained, but we need a generation to do it. And we have to stop rattling our sabers. That's a different way of approaching Iran. It's a different message to Israel. There are a lot of Israelis who feel a little uncomfortable with that kind of world and that worldview, because, after all, Israel has been promoted as a strategic asset in a kind of Manichaean us versus them world for a long, long time. So I think Israelis are being influenced to some extent by the election. I don't think that they will be making decisions decisively based on who will, in their view, win. As far as the Bolton idea that Bush will attack after the election, I think that would be unprecedented for an American president to really leave an incoming administration with that kind of mess to clean up.
Well, let's say that Israel does attack Iran. You say you don't believe it's imminent in any way, but let's talk for a minute about Israel's capabilities, because it sounds like many of the facilities in Iran are underground and that they could sustain multiple attacks. So what happens? What's the thinking on the Israeli side? Could they actually inflict damage on Iran's nuclear capabilities?
Well, I think, you know, with cluster bombs and bunker-penetrating bombs, you can inflict a lot of damage. The problem, of course, is that you'll also kill a lot of people. You'll also become an invading force. You'll rile up hundreds of thousands and even millions of people who would otherwise might be riled up against Ahmadinejad, because the oil prices are making it impossible for Iranians themselves to buy gasoline, because they're rationing gasoline there. You get the Tehran Bazaar, which wants to be part of economic globalization very actively working against Ahmadinejad on the one hand, suddenly becoming patriots, as in the Iraq war, the war between Iran and Iraq. You'll convert a tremendous number of people who might otherwise be putting their efforts into slowly taking down the Iranian regime internally into patriots who will act like the Iranians did against Saddam Hussein. I think it would be a disaster.
A lot of repercussions were Israel to attack Iran's nuclear capabilities. Bernard Avishai writes and blogs about the Middle East. His latest book is The Hebrew Republic. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Mark.
And this note about some of the stories in the works at Here and Now. NASA's Mars probe Phoenix has found ice on the red planet. Can life be far behind? And is that really good news for us Earthlings? Also, what makes a music standard a standard? We'll listen to a song that's now a must-learn for fiddlers and banjo pickers. We'll be back after the news, Here and Now. Another levee burst on the Mississippi River in Missouri this morning. The Elm Point Levee, 30 miles north of St. Louis, gave way in two places, swamping hundreds of acres of farmland. Flooding remains a concern in many communities. In Winfield, Missouri, sandbagged levee holding back the Mississippi is so waterlogged that emergency officials say it's like walking on a waterbed. Carol Brosman lives in Foley, Missouri. She says her losses are huge.
There isn't much left in there. There's a bathroom door, a bathtub, and a toilet. Everything else is gone.
Our next guest says if you are flooded, you essentially have three options. Fix the damage yourself, seek recovery through your insurance company, or sue. And courts are increasingly on your side. Ed Thomas is an attorney for the Michael Baker Engineering Firm based in Pennsylvania. He worked for FEMA for 35 years and is a nationally recognized expert in flood insurance and disaster relief. Hi, Ed.
Hi, how are you today?
Well, let's just say up front, you're not offering legal advice and you're not in any way speaking for FEMA during this interview.
Absolutely.
But let's talk about what you expect in terms of lawsuits as a result from the flooding in the Midwest. And what would people be claiming?
Well, people will have a very large number of claims out of the flooding in the Midwest. That's one prediction that one can make with a great deal of certitude. When I was down in Katrina, following Katrina, one of the things that struck me was the incredible proliferation of posters from attorneys who were seeking plaintiffs for one of the largest class action suits that is going on in the entire country, the over $248 billion worth of claims following Katrina. So we're going to see a lot of litigation. And of the ways that people can recover, litigation is by far the least efficient. It takes the longest, and it is very uncertain. So we're hoping that a lot of these folks have flood insurance, and others will, of course, be relying upon disaster relief, which is a form of social insurance, usually loans from the various disaster agencies.
But it sounds like more and more people are relying on litigation, which you say is it's inefficient and it's uncertain. But is it because fewer people have flood insurance?
Well, people often think that a levee is going to protect them. And the reality of the situation is the one thing we know about levees absolutely for sure is that there are two kinds, those that have failed and those that haven't failed so far this week but inevitably will. Levees are designed to fail. And it's hard for people to accept that a larger flood than what the levee's designed for is inevitably going to come along, and those people will be flooded and often flooded with catastrophic losses, as we saw down in New Orleans.
And as we're seeing now in the Midwest, I'm reading about a town in Gulfport, Illinois, where residents say FEMA and local officials told them the levee was strong enough to hold up to a historic flood. So many homeowners dropped their flood insurance, and only about 28 homeowners are insured when the town was submerged under 10 feet of water this month. Who's responsible there?
Well, it's hard to speak about specific facts, but on FEMA's maps, and of course I can't speak for FEMA, but I just tell you what it says on their maps, they don't say that anything won't flood. They say that there are different levels of probability of flooding taking place. It sounds like there may have been some misunderstandings or perhaps even miscommunication. It's hard to know what really happened in that case, but the message has got to be that if you're behind a levee and you're protected by a levee, inevitably that levee will fail. And if you don't have insurance, then you are going to be left with disaster relief, which will help with some partial recovery, or litigation.
Well, what about local governments? Are they on solid legal ground when they claim they're not responsible?
Well, anyone that has to do with a levee, whether you are the designer or the builder or the owner or the person responsible for maintenance, will be finding that litigation is in their future, very likely following a flood. The federal government has a statute that says that the United States is not responsible for damages from floods or flooding at any place, and yet the courts have found in some cases that that will not apply to even the federal government. So what we're seeing is an increasing erosion of the doctrines that would imply that people would not be responsible for damages, and inevitably what this will lead to is years and years of litigation.
Mm. So what should local governments do, or what can they do to protect themselves from lawsuits in the future and really protect their citizens from danger?
I think that there are three major things that will help all of us as a nation. The first is to communicate the risk properly so that people really do understand what a levee can do and what it can't do. Second is for there to be a system of warning and evacuation for us to accept that inevitably a levee will fail. And the third is to develop perhaps a broader system of national indemnification. The flood insurance program is an excellent and wonderful step in that direction, and yet we may need to look at ways of expanding that coverage so we don't see people basically forced into litigation. People behind levees need insurance. They need insurance from flooding. It's as simple as that.
So you say they need it, but who is required to have flood insurance?
Well, people that are seeking some type of federally backed loan, if they're in this special flood hazard area, the area of the floodplain that's especially and particularly hazardous. And that's where we get into the misunderstanding, because on the FEMA maps, they delineate various risk zones, and they have the especially hazardous areas, and then they have the areas that are outside these very specially hazardous locations. And those folks may be misled into thinking they don't need flood insurance, when in fact they do.
Well, why are they building in that area in the first place? Who's allowing them to do that?
Well, typically, it's going to be a question of local building codes and local zoning. The land, because it's floodplain, is just wonderful. It's usually flat. It's got glorious soil. It's easy to build upon. And it's a huge temptation to go from an agricultural use.
Yet but then it's better to put a housing development and earn a lot more taxes for the city?
Well, that is a decision that a lot of cities make.
Well, Ed, your bio notes that you live in a floodplain here in Massachusetts. Are you well insured for that?
I am insured for that. That is correct. Our building is elevated to the 1% or the 100-year flood level as calculated at the time of construction. We accept that part of the price of living in this beautiful piece of land, we're on the wetlands at the edge of Boston Harbor at Marina Bay, inevitably it will flood. Mother Nature will take this land back for a little while, and it will flood. I hope it doesn't happen during our lifetime or in the lifetime of anyone that will ever live here, but inevitably it is a possibility.
And Mother Nature is your client in many ways.
Mother Nature is, yes.
Ed Thomas, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Ed Thompson is a nationally recognized expert in flood insurance and disaster relief. He's an attorney for the Michael Baker Engineering Firm. And before we go today, a trash-talking robot's words of love. We talk to the creator of WALL-E. You're listening to Here and Now. City officials in Gloucester, Massachusetts, now say there is no evidence that a group of teenage girls made a pact to get pregnant. Time magazine reported last week that about half of the 18 girls who got pregnant at the high school this year formed a pact to have babies and raise their children together. We spoke to the Time reporter last week on Here and Now, and she said Principal Joseph Sullivan used the term pact. Today, one of those girls who got pregnant, Lindsay Oliver, told Good Morning America that there was no pact, but the girls decided after they got pregnant to help each other finish school and raise their kids. School Superintendent Christopher Farmer said even if there wasn't an agreement, some of the girls clearly didn't understand the consequences of their actions.
We also understand that some of them expressed pleasure at being pregnant. And clearly the worry for us is their lack of understanding as to what pregnancy at that age really means.
Joining us with more on this story is Ray Lamont, editor of the Gloucester Daily Times. The local paper first reported on the spike in teen pregnancies at the high school back in March. Welcome.
Hi, Monica.
And Ray, first of all, it seems like a lot of attention's being paid to whether or not there was a pact. Time stands by its story, but what has your paper found?
Well, we had never reported the term pact. We had, however, reported right from the start that some school officials, you know, including the principal, had suggested that a number of the girls had kind of gotten together and thought it would be cool to be moms together, become pregnant, and raise the kids together. It's clear a number of these pregnancies are very intentional, and I think that's the root of the problem.
Why do you think it is that everyone's focusing on whether or not there was a pact?
That's a little hard to tell. I never frankly thought of that as a hot button word that would really trigger a global media firestorm, but obviously for whatever reason it is and it was. We're getting concerned here, to be honest, that I think people are focusing more on that, whether something's defined correctly or not, and I think we're somewhat losing sight of the forest from the trees here. The clip that we heard just now of the superintendent's comment, I think he captured the key issue that we all need to address at this point, very seriously.
Yeah, so how is the community reacting to the story and all the world attention, as you say, that it's generated?
The community in the last few days, I think, has become a little bit shell-shocked. It's sort of odd because Gloucester is frankly not a newcomer to, you know, to global attention, being the site for the film The Perfect Storm, among other things. So people are used to having the city's name out there. They're extremely troubled, and understandably so. This is not the kind of thing that you want your city to be known for, and I think people are kind of reeling from it at this stage of the game.
And you noted in an opinion piece this week that none of the girls has dropped out of school, and perhaps that's because there's free daycare on site in the school. But importantly, too, while this year there were 18 pregnancies compared to 4 last year, the year before that, I understand there were 10, and 3 years ago, there were 16. So why do you think so many girls are getting pregnant in Gloucester?
It does fit, frankly, some socioeconomic stereotypes. It is a very much a tough blue-collar city. It depends still significantly on the fishing industry. The fishing industry hasn't gone away. It's still surviving and still trying to move forward, but it's certainly not thriving as it once was. One of the schools of thought is it's as basic as a number of these girls looking and seeing at what may be lying ahead for them, wondering what they're going to do, where they're going to get good-paying jobs in this area, and frankly deciding, well, I know I can be a mom. At least I can do that.
Do you see this as somewhat of a microcosm of things happening in the U.S., economic problems and whether or not schools should provide contraceptives without parental consent?
One of the reasons I think it's really captivated the nation's attention and the world's attention is that it does touch on so many issues. In this one news story, it touches on birth control issues. It touches on the plight of the family, the economy. It touches on education funding. It touches on healthcare funding and availability. I would be surprised if this case doesn't become cited one way or another as we go forward in the presidential election. It seems to touch on virtually every issue that's out there.
Ray Lamont is editor of the Gloucester Daily Times, speaking to us about the fallout from a story that several high school girls there intentionally got pregnant. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Still to come, robots on the big screen. We'll look at Disney Pixar's latest animation project in 1 minute, Here and Now. I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov. It's Here and Now. In the new film from Disney Pixar, the title character, Wall-E, is a trash-compacting robot. He's left alone on Earth when humans abandon the garbage-covered planet. As Wall-E faithfully roams through the rubbish, he collects things that catch his eye and dreams of a life with some companionship. Then one day, a spaceship lands to interrupt his solitude. Out emerges Eve, an advanced robot, looking for signs of life that would enable the human race to return to Earth. And when Eve finds those signs of life, Wall-E, who's fallen in love with Eve, follows her to the luxury spaceship where the last humans are waiting. And Wall-E discovers a world he never expected. Wall-E is the brainchild of director and co-writer Andrew Stanton, who also directed and co-wrote the Oscar-winning animated film Finding Nemo. Here and Now's Emiko Tamagawa caught up with Andrew Stanton when he was in Boston recently. She asked him about the genesis of Wall-E.
We had a lunch where we were trying to come up with what will we do after Toy Story, and we came up with A Bug's Life. But to get there, we had thrown out a bunch of other little half-baked ideas, and one of them was the idea of the sci-fi context of what if everybody left the planet and there was just this robot that didn't know it could stop doing what it's doing, and it did it forever. And I thought that was the saddest idea ever. And so you have to jump to 2002, and I'm in the middle of writing or rewriting on Nemo, and I suddenly thought about this little guy again, and I just wanted to explore it more. And by the time Nemo came out and was so successful, it really kind of gave me the confidence to try something this sort of outside of the box, because I figured that, one, the technology had advanced enough to probably realize what I was thinking we should do. We had become better filmmakers over all that time with all the other films, and I think there was enough trust from the audience with Pixar that they might come to see something that's a little different.
One of the things that, in a way, they're very different is Nemo is a very verbal film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of back and forth. There's a lot of humor. The first 15, 20 minutes of Wall-E is sound and music
mm-hmm.
without dialogue. Did you think that was going to be hard for audiences? Or
no, I completely have faith in the audience and know that they're smarter than anybody ever gives them credit for. It's just whether people would have the patience for me to figure out how to do it correctly and how to do it well enough that people would be completely engaged. Because I know when it's done well, because there's been plenty of moments like this in the history of cinema. It's just if you don't do it right, then it's annoying. And if you do it right, then people don't really even realize that they're being denied some element.
And the thing about Wall-E is he's got a very particular look. He's part tape player.
Mm-hmm.
He's very mechanical.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he's incredibly expressive.
Yeah. A lot of that came from finding the right design. The big epiphany was getting some binoculars handed to me at a baseball game. And I turned them around and I started making them sad and then mad and then happy and stern. And I realized the power of that. There was a whole character right there. And that was the big sort of opening. And then once we came up with all the other elements of making him a roving trash compactor, making him sort of collapse like a turtle, that gave him a very shy quality, then you just put it in the hands of really great animators. And those guys are just such a master of how to do a lot with a little. Just tiny movements can suddenly mean so much.
The first 20 minutes of the film, I mean, Wall-E breaks your heart because
mm-hmm.
he's wandering alone on this planet. And the only thing that he has that sort of gives him any pleasure is, you know, Hello, Dolly on the TV.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. Isn't that odd? Why? I know. I'm going to get asked that question for the rest of my life. Well, it didn't come right away. It was sort of a Reese's Peanut Butter Cup moment where my chocolate fell into the peanut butter. You know, I was just sort of playing this music of the song Put On Your Sunday Clothes when I was looking for sort of old songs. I was trying all these things because I knew I wanted something old-fashioned to listen to while you're looking at the future of space. And I loved that juxtaposition. And when that phrase out there got said at the head of the song, it just worked. And then the more I thought about it, I thought, you know, this song is about two naive guys that have never left their small little world and they want to go out and sort of experience life and all they really want to do is kiss a girl. And I thought, that's Wall-E.
Out there, full of shine and full of sparkle. Close your eyes and see it glisten, Barnaby.
And then I looked into other songs that were from that. Because I thought, what if he watched that movie? That was one of the things he found in the trash. And there was It Only Takes a Moment, and it showed these two people holding hands. And I realized that is the strongest way a character that can't say, I love you, show that they do. And that helped me so much in opening up the story and how to tell the story that I never looked back. For as odd of an idea as it is, I think it works really well.
And of course, into this solitude comes Eva.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, when I first saw this robot that does lasers and zips around, I thought she was out of Wally's league.
Yeah, she probably is. You know, I think he had to earn his place, you know, which most men do.
Wally!
This is a great movie for kids. You know, mm-hmm. It's fun. There is, shall we say, a less than flattering picture of what humanity could be.
Yeah. Well, the biggest thing I needed was some sort of something out of whack with humanity for Wally to have an effect on. And I thought the biggest thing I loved about Wally that I thought was so poetic was that he was a machine, yet he seemed to have more life than anything else. So I thought, what if humanity had lost the point of living? And so the biggest thing I was inspired by was distraction. Just it's already feeling like it's happening now, that there's a million things to keep you from really directly contacting or talking to the person next to you. You know, you can have your cell phone, your iPod, you name it, whatever your poison, and you can have a million things going on to keep you preoccupied, but you're not really living. And I thought, well, what if technology got so advanced that all the real issues of life, your health, how long you live, and food, and all that stuff got solved, and you'd have nothing to do but distract yourself. And so I that just made logical sense to me. And then the other fact that pushed me in that direction was when I found out that in research that NASA does for long-term residency in space, they have to really still solve the gravity issue, because if they don't get it just right, disuse atrophy kicks in and you would lose your bones slowly if you were out in space for too long. And sort of osteoporosis kicks in and you would eventually become a big blob of jello if you were out there too long. And so I thought that was a perfect way to portray people that had nothing to do. I didn't want it to be off-putting. I didn't want anybody to be slobs or unsightly. So I thought, well, what if nature sort of evolved you into sort of a baby, just big babies?
That's the thing, because they, you know, they are sort of blobby, but they're all very good-natured.
Right.
At least ones.
I wanted you to sympathize with humanity. I don't want you to dislike humanity. I want you to root for everybody having things improve.
The picture of it looks like the Earth in 700 years.
Yeah.
It's got this very bleak quality to it.
Yeah.
It's very dark.
I don't think it's that dark. My gosh. I mean, we listen to fairy tales about wolves eating people. I didn't see anything that dark about it. I just knew that it's a science fiction. It's about the future, and it's about the last robot on Earth. So I have to come up with some reason why everybody's gone, and it's not going to be a good reason that everybody leaves. So I knew that, you know, he was going to be this little wonderful light in the middle of all the sort of gray. And that would make people feel fine and that it was all going to be okay in the end. So I'm not too worried. I go to see a story to see why something will get improved or a problem will get solved or why something will change. I don't go to watch The Happy Village with happy people in it.
WALL-E writer and director Andrew Stanton speaking to Here and Now's Emiko Tamagawa. WALL-E opens in theaters nationwide on Friday. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov. Robin Young will be back tomorrow. Please join us again Here and Now.
Did you think that your feet had been bound by what gravity brings to the ground? Did you feel you were tricked by the future you